Welcome to Explore the Space. We're digging into healthcare issues that matter most. Our guests and conversations mine these issues for perspective and answers. There is a gulf between healthcare and our communities. This is the place to talk about it. Now here's your host, Dr. Mark Shapiro.
Welcome back to Explore the Space. This is part two of my interview with my colleague and friend, Dr. Guy Bezek.
We've got a lot more to cover, so we want to kind of jump back into it. When you're in the personal protective equipment, and I think a lot of the people who are listening to this podcast have seen the pictures, it's the heavy yellow suit, it's the face mask, the clear face mask, but your whole body's covered, right?
Yeah.
There's nothing exposed.
The goal is no exposed skin.
No exposed skin.
There may be a little airway area where something could get in, but no exposed skin is the
goal. Do you have cooling equipment? Or like, do you have a fan that's built in? Or I know that some of the ones that they demonstrated at our hospital when every hospital in the United States had to do its own Ebola preparedness things late last year, some of them had some built-in cooling equipment because they're hot.
Yeah.
You speak to it. How hot were these things?
It's definitely ironic. I mean, I saw a lot of those before I left to Africa.
Yeah.
But I saw zero of those when I got into Africa.
A lot of the cooling equipment.
Speaking of the PAPRs, these are the cooling equipments, the fans. We have a ton of those in the United States.
Yeah.
Down here, in Southern California. But in Africa, I didn't see one.
Wow.
So what you have is your ability to limit the time that you spend inside the Ebola treatment center. That's how you stay cool, you go in for short periods of time.
Okay.
And that's really your only option.
Yeah.
So if you... you know, the best shift is the night shift because it's cool, although it has problems with it. But in the day shift, if you're going in the afternoon at 2 p.m., you know, in Sierra Leone at that time that I was there, we'd have temperatures 95 to 100 Fahrenheit.
Outside. Okay.
But you put on the suit, you know, you spend 15 minutes putting all the different layers on, the boots, the gloves, the Tyvek suit, the face mask, the face shield, the cap. All those things, you know, 15 minutes late, and you're already sweating. If you took your scrubs off at that point, they'd be completely soaked through.
Wow.
And then you go in and start treating
patients. You
start working.
Oh, my gosh.
It's complete body coverage, so you lose all your mechanisms of cooling. You lose your evaporative cooling.
Uh-huh.
There's no wind. There's no movement of air through there.
Uh-huh.
And you're sweating, and so you generate, it's like a microclimate of 100% humidity. With the outside temperature of 95 degrees, and you know the temperature inside the suit on a bad day is 120 degrees probably. So
you can't function for very long.
You can't.
In that, right.
You can't, and your face shield will fog up.
Yeah.
And often does, and so you're providing medical care and for patients in a who have Ebola with very limited ability to provide that, and you. It's tough. So you limit it to about an hour and a half in terms of time spent in the suit.
How long does it take to put the suit on? From you're in your scrubs, you're ready to get started from that point to when you're fully dressed and ready?
Getting the suit on is probably about 7 minutes or so.
7 minutes. And you have someone supervising you while you're doing it, right?
Right, exactly. To make sure everything's covered, everything's tucked in and tied and nothing's exposed. And then coming out, when you come out, it's a very slow process. With hand washing with chlorine and spraying down with 0.5% chlorine.
Okay.
While
you're still in the suit. So you're still in the suit.
Yeah, you get sprayed down with chlorine. So you bring in a sprayer every time you go in.
Okay.
There's a guy with a big spray tank of 0.5% chlorine.
Okay.
And he sprays down, any potentially contaminated surfaces. He sprays down the vomit. If you get dirty, he'll spray down your apron.
Uh-huh.
Just so you try to limit, your potential for contagiousness. And then you go and you check out, you wash your hands with 0.5%, you take off layer after layer, you wash your hands after every single layer, and that's probably a 15-minute process to get out of the suit.
Is the temptation it must be there to rush and just get me the hell out of this stuff.
Yeah, for sure. And that's especially, there were always occasions when there'd be a little bit of a line for people trying to get out. Somebody would be
exceptionally hot. Oh, my gosh. So people are exiting at the same time, so you have to wait.
Sometimes, And that's the time when, you really start to feel the heat because your mind is not on anything else other than getting out, but you're just waiting.
And you just wait.
That was a tough time. But that would be risky because some people did get that inclination and would rush out and rush by and not go through the protocol, and
that's dangerous.
That's the danger.
Yeah,
that's the danger is when you don't follow the protocol.
And then when you're in the suit, how does communication work? If you need to communicate with someone outside the contaminated area, or can people, I mean, can people hear your voice? Is it muffled?
Yeah, so the communication between people in the treatment area is reasonable.
Okay.
You know, you work with a team and you talk to them. But at least at Mafforkey, where I worked, since it was somewhat of a makeshift Ebola treatment center, lines of communication to outside, to the green zone, from the hot zone to the cold zone, or from the red zone to the green zone, those lines of communication were very limited.
Okay.
So if you needed some piece of material and you didn't bring it in, you're pretty much out of luck.
Okay. And then as far as, were there language barriers with teammates in particular or other staff members? How was the, what was the sort of language that you guys were using to communicate?
In Sierra Leone, they speak, especially the medical staff speaks English, because a lot of their training is in English.
Okay.
So, you know, there were some problems, but most people spoke a bit of English, so it was okay.
So now we've taken our 10 minutes, we've been supervised, we've got our PPE on, it's hot, we're sweating, we're dehydrating kind of minute by minute. Take us into the hot zone. Take us into that room where you're actually laying hands on patients. What does it sound like? What does it look like? We're never going to see the inside of a room like that unless it somehow ends up on television.
Right.
What is that room like? Not just for you as a provider, but what your perception was of what it was like for a patient in there.
I mean, you walking into that door, the first time I walked in, it's a bit of a shock because it's a ward like other wards in Africa. You know, maybe 10 beds, 12 beds, all lying next to each other. But, you know, the difference is you're in this big white suit and you can't see well, your perspective is limited. But, you know, ultimately the real difference is about the patient experience, and the patients are, you know, for the most part, isolated without any family members, without anyone to, you know, help them clean themselves or to help them walk to the bathroom for simple things. You know, even though we would try to keep everyone clothed, it was hard when you have a disease that causes massive diarrhea. You'd go through 5-6 blankets a day just trying to keep things clean. So it's extremely demanding just keeping the area clean. So, you know, it's a hard place to keep, to upkeep. But when you walk into the ward, and, you know, sometimes you would see 4 or 5 patients, 6 patients, and maybe 3 of them would be critically ill. And we used a lot of cholera beds.
The cholera beds, the bed where they can lay on their back, and it's basically a cutaway underneath their backside. So when they void, when they have a bowel movement, it just goes right. It doesn't get on the bed or anything. It just goes into a chamber pot underneath the bed, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So when you have people who are so sick they can't get up to use the bathroom, or who are going to the bathroom every 5 minutes, it's almost a necessity to use that. But yeah, you'd have 3 people in that condition, and those were the confirmed, and you had maybe 2 or 3 other people. Maybe you had a 9-year-old, maybe you had a 2-year-old who were also very sick. So you had a mix of people sometimes. A 2-year-old next to a 50-year-old, next to a 70-year-old. Actually, there are not too many 70-year-olds in Sierra Leone. I think the average lifespan is 48.
They must have been trying to help each other as much as they could, too.
Yeah.
If they were physically able to.
Yeah, sometimes it would get to that point where you could get someone who's recovering from Ebola to take care of a small child. Because that's where the real psychological difficulty for me and for a lot of the workers comes in, is when you have a 3-year-old who you admit to the confirmed ward who has Ebola, and they don't have, you've separated them from their mother because she was, you know, Ebola negative, and she's back home maybe, you know, 3 hours away. And even if she was there, wouldn't be allowed to see her child. So you have a 3-year-old who's alone in an Ebola treatment center who has no one caring for him. And you would do your best. You'd go in for, you know, the time you had, maybe an hour, But then you left, and maybe nobody would see that kid for 4 hours, 5 hours. And this is a kid who's, you know, critically ill. I mean, that psychologically is very, very difficult to deal with for a healthcare worker, and for the child, I just can't even imagine. But kids are resilient, and some of them survived. But you know, for someone 5 years or younger to get Ebola, it was almost a death sentence. Because a lot of it was you just couldn't care for the simple parts, the nutrition and oral hydration. And a kid can't do that himself. So I think that was the hardest part. And we had, I mean, the time where morale for us, for me, for my colleagues was the lowest. I remember admitting within 2 days, probably related to an unsafe burial, within 2 days, we admitted a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 9-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 15-year-old. And within 4 days, all but one of them were dead. And yeah, that's hard to go on after, because you don't feel like you're doing anything. You don't feel like you're making a difference if you let these kids die. But you know, you understand the disease, and that's the disease. And you were there for, at least you were there to, you know, to help clean the kid up. You were there to help give him a drink of milk, or you know, the simple things that I was able to do still made it worth it to me, even for those patients who didn't survive. And it was, I mean, I'll never forget the 3-year-old, and despite the fact that I'm in this big spacesuit, and the night before he died, I remember him reaching out to me, and just like I was a regular person without a spacesuit, because he needed love and he needed to hug someone. And so I sat there with him for as long as I could, until it got to the point where I had to go out because I was at an hour and a half, and then I had to leave, and then he died the next day. And those are the tough cases. Definitely the kids.
Did they have mechanisms in place to communicate with their families when a child would pass?
Yeah, there were mechanisms. You know, we had psychosocial support teams and people out in the community by this time, you know, which in January and February. So that was in place. So, you know, that kid's parents, if they were alive still, you know, would hear that he had passed.
Would they be allowed to come and claim the body and grieve, I guess, as a family unit again, or no?
Generally not. I think sometimes they would allow the family to witness the body going into the ground at the Ebola cemetery from a distance, so they could witness it but not be really involved in any other, you know, traditions. But they could see it, yeah. But early on, you know, people would go to the treatment centers, and that's where a lot of the resistance was too, is people would end up going to these treatment centers and then never be heard from again, and none of their family would know where they went or if they died or if they were alive. There was another kid who was a survivor from Mafforki, and all of his family, his parents, and everyone was dead. But one day he was walking with one of the social workers outside, and he pointed at another child off in the distance, and the social worker looked at this little kid, I think he was a 5 or 6 year old, and said, "Do you know that kid? Do you know that other child over there who was maybe 9? And he said, "That's my brother." And they had thought his whole family was dead, but then they just randomly out on the street.
Oh my
this
God.
Little child pointed yeah. and found his brother, his last living relative. And so at least they were reunited and went to the orphanage together.
It is hard to conceptualize what that sort of human tragedy is like. I mean, we take care of patients here in a big, shiny hospital, and not to put down what we do wonderful work, and the healthcare community here is engaged and interested and empowered. If we didn't know what was going on, if there weren't people like you that were there, I don't think anyone would believe this stuff, because it's so separated from everything that we know and experience in the West. You know, as you were talking, you said you were talking about the patient experience, and we obviously spend a lot of time on patient experience, and we should. You know, we need to make sure we're doing the best things that we can for our patients and their family. It's something that's really important to me, and it's something that's really important to the healthcare community at large. It's an entirely different statement, it seems like, when you say it in this context. When you just, you're so limited, I suppose, in what you can do, but yet what you're doing is probably more meaningful than anything that I could envision doing, I suppose.
And, you know, that's true. Yeah, you know, I love what I do here, and I love being an emergency medicine doctor. But, you know, that those experiences will always be with me as something that I did that was more meaningful than any other experience I've had, I think, in terms of taking care of sick patients. I think, you know, you just have the capacity to do more for them than in any other situation, even if it is just those simple things. Even just, I mean, it's in a quarantine situation, an isolation situation, just being there and being there for their illness and mm-hmm. trying to support them when nobody else can, because their family can't be there and they're in quarantine or in isolation.
When you have, I guess probably every day you need something, there's something that you probably had to sort of decompress from, were there ways that you could kind of catch your breath and collect yourself? Was there resources, I suppose, in place? I don't know quite the right word for it to kind of get you ready, because 8 hours later you're going to go back in. And, you know, of course, this isn't to say that what you were going through is harder than the patients. Of course it's not, but you're going to go back and you're going to keep doing it. You know, in terms of collecting yourself and gearing up again, how does that process work?
Yeah, I think they had a good situation. We had a good situation with our living conditions, that things were fairly comfortable. We lived in a tent camp, but mind you, this was more of like a military-style disaster relief tent camp. It was put on by International Humanitarian Partnership and the Danish. And so everything was very organized, very clean. We had our own little bunks and our own little pods to sleep in. Fantastic food. The chef was great. I did some mountain biking while I was there. So there were ways to, you know, decompress. And you had a lot of colleagues. You know, in a situation like that, if you're alone, it's intolerable. You won't make it psychologically. But when you have other people going through that with you, by your side, with the same experiences, then it becomes manageable.
And in that same vein, did you see people who were infected, who were in the Ebola treatment center, trying to do the same thing for each other? They obviously don't have the same resources. They're in the treatment center, but I don't know, trying to keep morale up, trying to change the dynamic that's in there.
Right. That's a great question. I just go back to this vision I have of one of the survivors. You know, while he was in the Ebola treatment center, just dancing, and you know, he had been there 20 days, and I think he was a 29-year-old guy, and it was his birthday, and it was the day he found out that he tested PCR negative, meaning that he was a survivor. He was going to get discharged.
So he found out on his birthday that he had survived Ebola.
Exactly, that he was going to go
home. Oh my goodness!
And he did. He danced and he got his some of his friends in the same room, you know, some guys he had been through Ebola with and who were still there and who were going to be there for longer. And he did a little dance and, you know, he made everybody laugh. And so, yeah, there's a, you know, human heart in all of it, and it, that doesn't go away.
It's hard to figure out what that must have been like. I mean, it's like a second birthday, right? That this guy's able to have that kind of passing through. Were people happy for him? I mean, was it something like, was it a shared experience for other people?
To the extent that they were well enough to be there, yeah. And, you know, everybody has the same goal if you're a patient there, and that's to get out. But, you know, but it just goes to show you. I mean, there are no truly happy stories in Ebola. I mean, his, on that same day as well, he received word that his father, who is at another Ebola treatment center, had died. So the hits just keep coming with Ebola, he went home and he still had some family. You know, some patients weren't so lucky. Some went home to nothing. You know, as part of the discharge, I mean, that was the happy time, as happy as it could get, is when you had a survivor and you sent them home.
When you're sending them home, are you in regular clothing? Or are you still have to be in?
Yeah, it's the personal protective equipment. Interesting question, because, you know, they are coming out of a hot zone.
Yes.
So, you know, by principles of hot zone, nothing leaves the hot zone unless it's totally clean. So the process was, you would, all their clothes got burned, incinerated.
Yes.
All their belongings, cell phones, everything got incinerated.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
So, you know, they would drop everything they owned and go to what we call the happy shower, and basically wash off with soap and chlorine, and then sort of tiptoe to the exit.
Mm-hmm.
And at the exit, you know, they'd be greeted with a new set of clothing and a towel. And, you know, they were out. They took that step across the threshold, and they were survivors. And we had a little tree right at the entrance of the treatment center where all the survivors would tie a little band of fabric. And so this tree was covered in, I think we had over 300 survivors, so it was covered in all these 300 some bands from the survivors.
Yeah.
And then they would, you know, we had in the Ministry of Health and some of the other NGOs supplied them with a mattress, because all their belongings at home were burned. Mm-hmm. So they got a mattress and a sack of flour and maize or corn and several other belongings, money for a new cell phone. And then they went home if they had a home or if they had family to go to.
Yeah. And when they crossed that threshold, were the people on the other side dressed in regular clothes, or were they in the personal protective equipment still?
I think at this point, because it was so close to a hot zone, they wore what we call light PPE, which isn't full, but it's, you know, gloves and a little bit of a gown.
When's the first time they get to shake another human being's hand with nothing between them?
As soon as they step out that's it.
Wow.
If you want to shake his hand, then you know, and that's good. Everyone should do that.
Yeah.
But you do wonder, because the cleaning protocol depends on how well he washed and showered himself. And, but that's just part of it, I guess.
What are the communities around these Ebola treatment centers like, the ones that you are at? I mean, are these communities, are they still functioning communities? Do they still have the basic fundamentals, running water, access to food, communication?
Yeah.
Or are they not? Are they falling apart?
Yeah. You know, at baseline, these places might not have had running water, and most didn't have electricity. So Sierra Leone is very poor. It's hard for me to say, you know, what it has become compared to what it was 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you walk through the streets or you go down to the market, and it feels like bustling West Africa still.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot different that I could see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it still functions. But then, you know, there's days when there's lockdowns and there's checkpoints at all the roads, and every restaurant you walk into, They're going to check your temperature with infrared thermometer. Wow. Yeah. They're going to have you step through bleach wash. So there's, you know, little changes, but,
yes,
you know, life goes on,
yeah,
as in anything.
This sounds like it sounds like an unbelievably resilient community of people.
Yeah, yeah, you have to, and to go through everything they've been through, and,
yeah,
you know, and with civil wars and poverty and civil unrest, and then now Ebola.
Yeah,
but that's the nature of Ebola too. Is it looks for places like that. It
right.
looks for places that have been through war.
Yeah.
That's the nature of plagues, really.
Yes,
yeah. War and plague goes.
They go hand,
goes
in, hand.
Hand in hand
for sure. So when you left, what was your route home? You probably had to come through one of the checkpoints on United States soil to re-enter the country, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So back through Brussels, uh-huh. and then from Brussels to Newark.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, uh-huh. because I think that was a political hotspot for early on. But,
yes, it was.
But
yes,
you know, the CDC has, you know, designated, I think, 4 or 5 airports as
yeah.
entryways, and so
yeah.
the system's figured out. I mean, you're on a plane with, going from Brussels to the U.S., you're on a plane with people who weren't in
yeah.
West Africa.
People who...
Guys who were just
work
visiting.
At NATO in Brussels.
Right.
Yeah.
Brussels, who were on vacation in Europe.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You're sitting next to them, and then, but then you get to the U.S. and you're siphoned off into a special screening.
Okay.
And it's nice. I mean, they've got water for you.
Yeah.
Granola bars. And you don't spend 8 hours in a tent anymore
yeah,
there
yeah.
in isolation. So they just ask you a few questions. They identify what your risk is
uh-huh.
and basically identify what your quarantine will be. But ultimately that becomes a county by county issue,
uh-huh.
the nature of the quarantine that you'll be
okay.
under when you come back.
So San Diego County knew that you were going?
I did them the favor, gave them a heads up before I left.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they monitored me.
Okay.
Basically through FaceTime, really.
Okay. So how long after you got to Newark were you allowed to come back to San Diego?
Pretty immediately. I had a connection 4 hours after I
landed. Oh, okay.
And
yeah.
so there was not much delay.
Okay.
Just took a regular flight back
yeah.
to San Diego
yeah.
and went home. And
then you were quarantined.
There for 21 days.
So it was a 21-day quarantine.
Yeah, 21
okay.
days.
Yeah.
Yep.
And what were you allowed to, what were you not allowed to do during your quarantine time?
Well, San Diego Public Health was, I think, reasonable, at least in the context of a, you know, politically charged issue. They were reasonable and very nice to work with, and they, you know, forbid any congregate activities. And that means you can't go to a place where you're around a lot of people you
mm-hmm.
don't know
mm-hmm.
and who can't be traced if you were to get sick.
Okay.
So you can't go to a movie theater, to a restaurant. To the shopping mall, but if you want to go take a bike ride in the park, yeah, go for it. You're not
mm-hmm.
going to expose anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And first off, you know, I wasn't sick. I wasn't infectious.
Yeah.
But the real goal is to keep, to make the public health work easier
mm-hmm.
so that if you happen to get sick when you were out in public, there's not a ton of potential exposures that they need to trace.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was reasonable. Not every state is reasonable. Some states still have a complete home quarantine lockdown, even for people who are extremely low risk,
mm-hmm.
you know, who did not have significant patient interaction.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's when, you know, I don't want to get political, but when politics is hindering the response to an epidemic, then you can't ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think a lot of people who could have responded and would have responded didn't go because
uh-huh.
of their state's quarantine.
Uh-huh.
And I think
that's a
really
huge
sad
limitation. Yeah.
That you know, they've stopped people from going.
Yeah. So now you've re-entered your life. You're back to work. Obviously, Ebola is not on the front page of the newspaper anymore. I think a lot of physicians, you know, I go to conferences and I talk with lots of people. We know that it's still active. It's not over. It started all with one single case, which
right.
they've been able to determine what it is. Where are things now? Where do things stand now in terms of, there's nothing that different in West Africa compared to 6 months ago. Obviously, there's no cases in the United States right now, but there's still people,
yeah.
whole communities
sure.
stricken there now. What are the steps that we as a community in the United States can be taking to help people like you when you go over there to have the stuff that you need and then be able to get it to the people who are in the most desperate need.
Yeah, well, and on your first point, I mean, you're exactly right. The outbreak is still ongoing, and if you just took the cases that happened over the past month, that still is by itself the largest outbreak in history prior to this one. So you're still dealing with a huge outbreaks with a ton of cases, and for a while, Guinea was actually getting worse. Sierra Leone has been improving, and Liberia, you know, we're back on track to try to get to 42 days case-free, but the outbreak is still there, and the number one enemy now is complacency. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the goal is zero cases, because like you said, this started with one single case.
Yeah.
It was a jump of the virus from bat,
right,
to a little boy.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime you have a single case out there, you have the risk for a massive outbreak. So until we get to zero, nobody will feel comfortable. So I think it is important that we complain about maybe too much media coverage now, but now it's sort of disappearing off the radar, and we need to pay attention, and we need to keep the fight up. So I think, I think they still need manpower. So if there's people who, healthcare workers, epidemiologists, social workers, psychologists, then there's still the need for those people to go out there and contribute manpower. And otherwise, you know, donations are definitely important. And just talking about it and keeping it in people's, I mean, like you're doing today, is very important, just to keep talking about it and keep it up as an issue so that we don't forget about it. Partners in Health has been an outstanding organization, and they are there for the emergency response, but they're also there for the long term. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not a disaster response organization. They're a health systems building organization. And they're going to be there for years, if not mm-hmm. decades.
Mm-hmm.
And that's organizations like that, and the governments are going to be the ones that prevent future outbreaks
mm-hmm.
By building those systems and mm-hmm. putting them into place. So, you know, contributing to Partners in Health
mm-hmm.
Would be a great way of helping out.
Mm-hmm.
And MSF, of course, who's been there from the beginning.
And MSF stands for?
Medicine Sans Frontières.
Oh, that's right. It's the French.
Doctors Without Borders.
It's Doctors Without Borders. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
And of course, they have been there from the beginning, and they are still doing a heavy share of the work. Mm-hmm. So
we'll make sure, if our listeners want to go to explorethespaceshow.com, we'll have the websites for those two institutions available if you want to review the work that they're doing, and if you want to make a donation to help them in the work that's being done in West Africa. Certainly everyone should feel free to do so and feel very empowered to do so. I feel very lucky that you took some time to come and sit down and talk about your experiences and be so frank and honest. It's difficult material to listen to. I'm sure it was difficult to bear witness to it as you did, and I can't imagine what it's like for the people there who are having to go through this, but these are the ways that we have now as a human community to share experiences and raise awareness, and myself, and I know a lot of other people in our own community of physicians, really stand in awe of what you've done and are very grateful that you've been able to come home safely and take some time and tell us about what you saw, what people are going through, what they've gone through, and what is still happening. So thank you so much for coming, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for listening to Explore the Space. Visit us on our website, explorethespaceshow.com, and please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at ETSShow, and you can email Dr. Shapiro by writing to mark@explorethespaceshow.com.